A citizen boasted to me about their million-dollar courthouse. A plain yet pleasing century-old fieldstone building sitting high on the mountainside. Albeit a little cynically, since construction cost a fraction of that. But through compound interest and refinancing, the price finally hit $1 million. The courthouse was condemned 3 years before the mortgage was paid off. The highway went down into a narrow and immensely long Thunder of Hooves Valley, then, like a chalk line, headed north, running between two low mountain ranges, the higher eastern one still in snow. A sign. Next gas, 80 miles. In the dusk, the valley showed no evidence of man other than wire fences, highway, and occasional deer crossing signs that looked like medieval heraldic devices. On a field of ochre, a stag rampant, sable. The signs had been turned into colanders by gunners, almost none of whom hit the upreared bucks. Squat clumps of white sage, wet from a shower out of the western range, sweetened the air, and gulches had not yet emptied. Calm lay over the uncluttered openness, and a damp wind blew everything clean. I saw no one. I let my speed build to 60, cut the ignition, shifted to neutral. Although Ghost Dancing had the aerodynamics of an orange crate, it coasted for more than a mile across the flats. When it came to a standstill, I put it back in gear and left it at roadside. There was no one. Listening, I walked into the scrub. The desert does its best talking at night, but on that spring evening, it kept God's whopping silence. And that, too, is a desert voice. I've read that a naked eye can see 6,000 stars in the 100 billion galaxies, but I couldn't believe it. What with the sky white with starlight? I saw 1 million stars with one eye and 2 million with both. Galileo proved that the rotation and revolution of the Earth give stars their apparent movements, but on that night his evidence wouldn't hold. Any sensible man, lying on his back among new leaves of sage, in the warm sand that had already dried, even he could see Arcturus and Vega and Betelgeuse just above, not far at all, wheeling about the Earth. Their paths cut arcs, and there was no doubt about it. The immensity of sky and desert, their vast absences, reduced me. It was as if I were evaporating, and it was calming and cleansing to be absorbed by that vacancy. Whitman says, "Oh, to realize space, the plenteousness of all, that there are no bounds, to emerge and be of the sky, of the sun and moon and flying clouds, as one with them." On the highway, a car came and went, sounding a pitiful brief whoosh as it ran the dark valley. When I drove back onto the road, I saw in the headlights a small desert rodent spin across the pavement, as if on wheels. From the mountains, my little machine must have looked much the same. Ahead hung the Big Dipper with 1 million galaxies, they say, inside its cup. And on my port side, atop the western range, the evening star held a fixed position for miles until it swung slowly around in front of me, and then back to port. I had followed a curve so long I couldn't see the bend. Only Vesper showed the truth. The highway joined U.S. 6 from Cape Cod to Long Beach, the longest federal route under one number in the days before interstates, then crossed the western mountains. Below lay the mining town of Ely. Not everything that happens in Ely happens at the Hotel Nevada, but it could. The old place is ready for it. But that night the blackjack tables were empty, the slots nearly so, and the marbleized mirrors reflected the bartender's slump and a waitress swallowing a yawn. Yet I did see these things. Item. A woman, face as blank as a nickel slug, pulling dutifully on the slot handles. She had stood before the gears so many times, she herself had become a mechanism for reaching, dropping, pulling. Her eyes were dark and unmoving, as if unplugged. The periodic jangle of change in the winner's cup moved her only to reach into the little coffer without looking and deposit the coins again. Item. A man moseyed in, wearing leather from head to toe, attempting cowpuncher macho, he looked more like a two-legged first baseman's mitt. With him, a bored blonde. "I'm a very competitive person. I'm in it to win," he said, and the blonde yawned again. Item. In a glass case hung a cross-section of bristlecone pine. At its center, a card said, 3000 B.C., Building of the Pyramids. A seedling today could be alive in the year 7000. That put a perspective on things. Over another beer, I watched faces that would be lucky to see A.D. 2000. When I left, a man in a white goatee whispered, "No game's a chance, cowboy." "Haven't finished losing the first one," I said. 6. Tradition persists in Nevada. You can see it, for example, in the whorehouses of Eli. Prostitution is legal in White Pine County because miners, in order to work efficiently in the ground digging for this and that, traditionally require whores. The next morning, I overfilled my gas tank, splattering no lead around, because I was eavesdropping on a conversation about the going price of a trick. A man with a white beard — there are more per capita white beards in Nevada than any state other than Alaska — said to a tourist with a prissy little mustache a la mode, "I don't know all the prices, but I heard girls at the Big Four are getting 25 simoleons for a straight." Another white beard said, "Used to be 10. Hell, it used to be 5. We got old just in time, didn't we, Boyd? Could you do a dollar's worth of damage now?" "Couldn't do a lick of damage." A young man replacing a wiper on the tourist's Camaro said, "A lick's all either of you could do. You coots keep your jeans zipped. Last night a couple girls got to swinging knives because one had more hours on her check." "Calling them hours now, are they?" Boyd asked. The tourist, trying to be one of the men, said, "Got a friend in Denver whose wife charges him $5 a jump. She's buying furniture with it." "Now that's real whoring," Boyd said. "These girls are just trying to make a living. Why don't your friend take on the neighbors over the back fence? She could buy a Florida vacation, too." When I went to the road again, clouds obscured the sun, and a damp wind came out of the north. The mountainsides along Highway 50 west of Eli were shot through with abandoned mining tunnels, the low entrances propped open by sagging timbers. They were the kind of old-time mines that Walter Brennan might come limping out of, chortling his crazy laugh. Magpies, looking like crows dressed for a costume party, swooped from fence post to post and flicked wings in the mist. The highway was a long, silver streak of wet. Up into the Pancake Mountains, driving, driving, wishing the day would dry off. After all, this was the desert. But the sky remained dark as dusk. I looked out the side window. For an instant, I thought the desert looked back. Against the glass, a reflection of an opaque face. I couldn't take my attention from that presence that was mostly an absence. Whitman. This the far-off depth and height, reflecting my own face. This the thoughtful merge of myself, and the outlet again. Other than to amuse himself, why should a man pretend to know where he's going, or to understand what he sees? Hoping to catch on to things, at least for a moment, I was only following down the highways a succession of images that flashed like blue sparks. Nothing more. The experience of the desert anchorite, St. Anthony, is typical of men who go off into deserts. Hunger, solitude, and vastness engender not awareness or redemption so much as phantasmagoria. Under desert bushes, St. Anthony saw naked girls, behind stones, dragons, and in shadows, the deformed demons of Satan. My guess is that he was finding the consequence of his own imagination. I had only a vacancy of face on the window, so maybe a simple slice of salami would dispel it. At Hickason Summit, a long rise formerly called Ford's Defeat, because a Model T needed to be pulled up it by real horsepower, I stopped at a wayside set back in a box canyon of wet juniper and sage. The scent of plants saturated the mist. Alexander the Great, I've heard, was preserved in honey, Lord Nelson in brandy, and Jesus and aloe and myrrh. If I can choose, I'll take my eternity in essence of sage and juniper. After a sandwich and some wine, I walked up the canyon. In the evergreens, a pipping of invisible birds and the slow drip of rain. The stones were wet through and through, but their blanched surfaces didn't glisten. Even the desert rocks seemed designed to hold moisture. Wind and water had cut the canyon wall into peculiarly sensuous shapes, and on rocks the elements had left blank, Indians of 1,000 years ago carved sacred designs. The Bureau of Land Management had fenced off the petroglyphs, but stick figures, concentric circles, and rectangles stood out clearly from the damp stone. To the Indian, these cuttings were not pictures or objects so much as events. They carried life. At the west end, where the fence came close to a ritualistic chiseling, I reached over and traced my finger along an incised abstraction now polished by years of hands. A cryptic engraving. Then I saw that the design wasn't at all abstract, but rather a graphic rendering of a female pudendum, a glyph even Cro-Magnons carved. In a time so long ago no descendant can remember any of it, an Indian had cut his desire, or coming of age, or hope for regeneration, into the pink sandstone. It was as if I touched another dimension, a long skein of men, events, places. It was as if I had reused the image. I walked back to the ghost and drove to the highway. The sky began to open and the mist to dissipate. On the map, I noticed a thermal spring to the south. I wandered around side roads before Spencer's Hot Springs appeared on a knoll under the snowy Tokima Mountains east of Austin. When I saw the blue pools steaming, there was no question in my mind. With only 5 Nevadans to the square mile, in actuality many fewer when you discount Las Vegas and Reno, I figured I could get by undisturbed. Behind a cover of thistle and spiny hop sage, I stripped and dished up the hot water. Let it cool slightly, then poured buckets of it over me. I even slapped on hot, gritty, blue-gray mud to loosen the sinews. Then I rinsed clean, as men before must have done, dumping over me water warmed by the molten heart of the earth. 7. They hanged a horse thief 3 times one day in Austin, Nevada, because the hangman couldn't get the length of rope adjusted properly. But he was a conscientious public official and kept at it until he got it right. About the only thieving going on now was siphoning gasoline out of automobiles by people who came through at night and found the stations closed. After dark, the next gas was a couple of hours away. Austin, in a canyon on the west slope of the Toyabe Mountains, was a living ghost town. 40% living, 50% ghost, 10% not yet decided. It was the seat of Connecticut-sized Lander County, mainly because only one other place, Battle Mountain, could you honestly call a town. But now Battle Mountain, with 6 times the population, thanks to the interstate and new power plan, wanted the government up there, where old mines were starting to produce again as the price of silver rose. Time was working against Austin. Once the county seat went, so would Austin, they said. A man commented, "We'll be all but finished down here. 25 years ago, a fellow wrote a book about us called The Town That Died Laughing. Stick your head out the window and listen to all that laughing. You ask me, I don't believe one damn bit in change." On 3 sides of town, prospect holes riddled the mountains and dripped out mine tailings like ulcerated wounds. To the west, several 100 feet down, lay a flat desert valley disappearing into the Shoshone Mountains on the horizon. Main Street, also U.S. 50, made a straight and steep run through Austin, then down the mountain and off across the desert. The side streets were hard-packed, oily sand, some with gradients that would test a donkey, and the rutted sidewalks, washing down the slope, still had their old west canopies. Because Austin is without level land, many of the houses had been built into terraced cutouts so that, from their porches, people looked down onto the roofs of buildings along Main Street. I liked Austin. The house chimneys slipped a wispy smoke from juniper hearth fires, and the cracked brick and stone of the storefronts, more or less, had been left alone. An 1890 photograph showed things little changed, other than the defunct one-car railroad running up Maine. Here, too, the Nevada story. 1862. A Pony Express rider looking for a lost horse finds a rock loaded with silver ore. 1865. 6,000 people, and as many mining and milling companies, hundreds of them fraudulent. 1878. The mines virtually played out. A century later, 300 people, about the same number as in the old cemetery at the edge of the mountain, where the names were English, Polish, Italian. In a small back room with walls, ceiling, and floor going off at a variety of angles, not one of which was 90 degrees, I had a hamburger. After dinner, I walked the town over. But the damp night got to me, and I went into Clara's Golden Club, one of six bars, to shake the chill. It was a fine, worn place with trophy heads. The dusty deer wore a tie. Against the east wall stood a century-old back bar supported by four Corinthian columns of mahogany. The silver on the mirror had cracked apart, breaking the faces that watched from it, and sections of brass bar rail were scuffed through. Clara, toes snugged under a drowsing sheepdog, wore a shapeless lavender sweater and a clerk's green visor to hold back her gray hair. She rapped coins at the empty blackjack table. Behind her a sign, "No one under 21 near table. Min, $1 fine, max, $5. The way her shoulders bent over the clinking coins brought to mind Madame Defarge, knitting needles clicking ceaselessly, overseeing the fates of men. I ordered a draft. Everyone at the bar, cattlemen, sheepmen, miners, wore the Nevada uniform, a down vest. Periodically, someone threw a coin on top of the 10-foot back bar. I asked a man, whose brow opened and closed like a concertina as he talked, what was going on. "Crazy," he said. "They've been doing that to bring luck for years. No telling how many silver dollars behind that mirror. Who knows what else? One time a double eagle was the smallest piece of change you got in Austin." He shifted around to talk. "Go out to the mountain edge and look at Stokes Castle. Everything's falling down now, but you can get an idea of the money we used to have here. Took $50 million in silver ore out of these mountains before they went empty." A man named Vern said, "Mine's gonna come back, Johnny, soon as the price of silver gets high enough." "Been slinging that for 100 years, Johnny said. He put his arm on my shoulder. "Right here, it's the only mine worth talking about now. These Californians and New Yorkers. Mining and ranching together don't equal half what these boys bring into the state. I read that in print." A woman playing the slots stepped to the bar for a rum. Her T-shirt once carried a message, but soap and sun had bleached it to unreadability. "You wouldn't play those if you were deaf," Johnny said.
"I'd play them if I was dead."
She returned to her relentless pulling. I asked what he meant. "People play slots because of sound. Gears turning, money jangling like in an old trolley. Same reason pinball machines got noises. Bandits wouldn't turn a dime if they didn't rattle and roll." Johnny and Vern took the bar dice and rolled horses to see who would plug the jukebox. Johnny won. "Don't play the dirty one, or my wife will get wind of it again." Vern made the selections and went to the toilet. The music came on, country and western, thump, thump, thump.
"Dang him," Johnny said. "He played that dang song. Now he'll tell the wife I paid for it."
Johnny yelled toward the back.
"Dang it, Vern!"
A cackle from the Jakes. Johnny didn't talk during the music. I think he was listening. As best I could make out, this was the dirty part. "I got the hoss, she's got the saddle, dum, dum, dum. Together we gonna ride, 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 dum, 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 all night long." We ordered another round. Johnny said, "Bag of flour sold here once for $250,000. That's why the town seal's got a bag of flour on it."
"What?"
He repeated it very slowly.
In my mind, I saw a furred aquatic animal balancing a sack of daisies on its nose. I don't follow you. In bonanza days, after the Civil War, a grocer made a bet with a fella on an election. Whoever lost had to carry a 50-pound bag of wheat flour up Main Street. Now, just walking that street taxes a man. Grocer lost. So he carried 50 pounds up Main to the tune of John Brown's body. He was a Southerner. After he got to the top, he auctioned the bag off and gave the money to charity. The man who bought it auctioned it off and gave the money to charity. And so on. Made $10,000 that day off the same bag. Later, another town got wind of it, and they wanted in. Last time that flower got auctioned was at the 1904 World's Fair in St. Louis. That dang bag raised better than $250,000, and that's why the official town seal is a bag of flour. It's over in Reno now. You mean with all the great natural wonders around Austin, the town symbol is a sack of stale flour? Tell me, mister, what's more unusual, a pine tree or flour at $5,000 a pound? We bought each other a third round, and Johnny said, "Think a smart New Yorker like you can tell a religion by the way people pay for their church?" "Don't know what you mean." "Three new churches built in Austin after the Civil War when the town had money. Methodist, Episcopalian, Catholic. This is a true fact. One church pays for the building with one pass of the collection plate on Easter Sunday. One pays with donated mining stock, which it sells in the East. And one makes the first mortgage payment by charging admission. Who did what?" "All right," I said. "The Catholics charged admission. Okay. Episcopalians had the stock. Wrong." "I said the church was given the stock. Episcopalians had the cash. Methodists had the investments. Businessmen's religion. You ought to know that." Just before I left, the woman at the slots gave the quarter bandit a perfect pull, and the machine clattered coins into the metal cup and onto the floor. One made a long, circling roll across the room and passed by the nose of the sheepdog. The animal half-raised its eyelids, saw the coin, and went back to its snooze. 8. New Pass Station, under cliffs of the Desitoya Mountains and half an hour west of Austin, used to be a stagecoach stop. The cold morning I pulled in to make breakfast, it was a tumble of stone walls and the willow thatch roof had long since gone to compost. These stations were crude shelters even when the overland ran the route. A traveler in 1861 described Cold Spring, the next stop west, as a wretched place, half-built and wholly unroofed. He spent the night in a haystack. What I took for a ruin was, perhaps, a reconstruction. I found my cooler empty except for some sardines and a can of chopped liver. So I went on along the stage road, also once the Pony Express Trail, and the route of the first transcontinental telegraph. Add to those the journeys of Indians and 49ers, and Highway 50 is one archaeological layer of communication upon another. Regardless of the utter fierceness of desert winters and summers, the Pony Express riders, they say, always rode in shirt sleeves. Considering the real hazards of the job, that may be true. The Central Overland California and Pikes Peak Express, the actual name of the Pony Express, used to run notices that are models for truth in advertising. An 1860 San Francisco newspaper printed this one. Wanted: young, skinny, wiry fellows, not over 18. Must be expert riders willing to risk death daily. Orphans preferred. Despite, or because of, such ads, never was there a shortage of riders. The only baggage the boys carried, in addition to the male mochila, was a kit of flour, cornmeal, and bacon, and a medical pack of turpentine, borax, and cream of tartar. Not much in either one to keep a rider alive. A letter cost $2.50 an ounce, and if the weather and horses held out and the Indians held off, it might go the 2,000 miles from Missouri to California in 10 days, as did Lincoln's inaugural address. But the primary purpose of the service was neither the speedy delivery of news or correspondence. Rather, the express comprised part of the Northern defense strategy during the Civil War by providing a fast central link with California that Southern raiders couldn't cut. For the 17 months the Pony Express existed, it helped to hold California in the Union. What's more, this last of the old world means of communication, before mechanical contraptions took over, left a deep mark on the American imagination. The riders, going far on little, became touchstones of courage and strength. 9. Frenchman, Nevada, population 4, sat on the edge of a U.S. Navy bombing range. As if that weren't enough, it was also on a fault zone that still wobbled the seismographic instruments around. Frenchman appeared on my map as a town, and in the desert it probably was a town, consisting as it did of a cafe, bar, filling station, four-unit motel, trailer, and water tower, all huddled on an expanse of dry lake bed mudflats, cracked into a crazed jigsaw puzzle of alkali hardpan. In a state abounding with uninhabitable places, Frenchman excelled. Without vegetation, suffering from unrelenting wind and extremes of temperature, no source of food or supplies closer than 36 miles, no medical care other than Band-Aids and Mercurochrome, frequently rattled by bombs and earthquakes, Frenchman somehow survived on a single source of income, highway travelers. A little east of town, a road sign warned of low-flying airplanes in Dixie Valley. Since Ghost Dancing was not equipped with anti-aircraft guns, I took cover in the cafe, where red neon tubes spelled out ice cream, and a scrawled sign said, "No guns in bar." Just what you'd expect of a bombing range cafe. The warm, knotty pine room smelled of hot coffee and a baking cake. I ordered a standard road breakfast, then noticed the peppermint green Hamilton Beach mixer, the old drugstore model, and added a chocolate milkshake. A young woman poured coffee, although I hadn't asked for it. "Better on thaw. Cold air's numbed you out if you're ordering a milkshake. I mean, it's 50 degrees and breakfast time." "Any time is chocolate milkshake time," she stared at me. "The best part is the beaters hitting the metal cup. That's what puts the flavor in." She went to the kitchen, and I heard her say to someone, "I believe the desert's got to that boy." Two men sat down. One asked for an egg and a slice of lemon pie, the other a vodka and root beer. She didn't bat an eye at that order. The lemon pie man was a geologist who carried a trail bike in his pickup to check claims in a real backcountry the truck couldn't reach. He talked about a mountain lion someone had shot in the Toyabes. He couldn't remember when that last happened. Vodka and root beer said, "Why don't somebody shoot one of them damn Mustangs?" "Guy down at Tonopah got acquitted for stealing Mustangs," the woman said. "Well, of course. He probably saved the horses. Yeah, there's a place in Idaho where the wild herd went from 100 to 500 in 7 years. "What's the problem with the horses?" I asked. "The Mustangs are sick and starving because they've overpopulated," the geologist said. "Desert can't support but a few things. Takes 50 acres just to feed a steer, and horses crop grass so short they kill it. Worse than sheep. People get emotional about Mustangs because they think they're wildlife. Horse apples. Half are strays, got brands on them. It's not even like coyotes that have been here all along." "Every damn thing now is this environment shit," Vodka said. "Gotta call Washington so you can cut sage on your own land. Shoot a sick horse, and them environmentalists sign a petition. Shoot a man, and they smile." "Those eastern laws are creeping in," the geologist said. 9/10 of this state is in the public domain. Let's keep out of each other's way, okay, buckaroo?" I nodded. "Sure, we gotta have laws, and we do. And I'm not supporting the snake oil boys in Carson City wanting to legalize Laetril and Gerovital so they can turn Nevada into the monkey gland capital of America." The woman brought my breakfast and whipped up the milkshake. Vodka said, "What the hell's going on with that goddamn milkshake?" "Him," she said. The geologist asked her what the new power lines coming out of Fallon were all about. "Navy's converting to television and computers along the bombing runs. No more observers in the towers." I'd feel safer if the Navy was sitting out here with me, instead of just a camera, the geologist said. They still drag out old trucks for targets?
Sometimes. But planes are dropping more flares now instead of bombs, saving money. When they make night runs, those flares light up the whole valley. Fantastic show. Just as well they can see us, I guess. Plane dropped a bomb on the highway last year and nearly killed some clown in a car.
Exploded on the road?
Just bounced up on the pavement and rolled dead, and he almost ran into it. Came in here afterwards, white as salt. He said, "Miss, I haven't been drinking, but I just got bombed out there." We called the Navy, and of course they claimed it was only a dummy bomb.
Trying to get off the hook and ease your mind.
Ease my mind? When a plane off course actually bombed Fairview a couple months ago?
I never heard anything in the news about the Navy bombing a town, I said.
Fairview's a ghost town, up on the ridge above the valley. Nothing but kangaroo rats. Navy sent out a crew and piled rocks back on the walls and shoveled dirt in the craters and picked up the shell fragments.
Don't tell me this isn't a crazy state, the geologist said. A Navy jet in the desert bombing a ghost town.
The planes used to fly off carriers in the Pacific for runs in here. Can you believe flying off the ocean to bomb Nevada? Now most of them fly out of the base at Fallon. They've changed it all over to electronic warfare, EW, they call it. Planes come in on a bombing run flying real low, almost reach up and poke them with a stick. They try to slip in under the radar, and that's what worries me. Two T-28 trainers already crashed this year. I don't mind the bombs, but I don't want a jet in the cafe.
Is the shelf booze behind chicken wire because of bombs? I said.
Not bombs so much, although when they go off, everything jumps pretty good, especially me. One explosion opened that crack. She pointed to an inch-wide fissure in the wall. An explosion on Bravo 17? That's the closest run. That's what did that. But the chicken wire's for earthquakes. The big one in 54 broke every jug in the house.
A miner, who had worked at Shelite Mill a few years ago, came in. "I have a wild turkey on the rocks," he said loudly.
"Not here you won't,"
the woman answered. "Why not? Law won't let you serve miners?" He guffawed at his joke.
The woman said either, "Don't have any turkey," or, "Don't have any turkey."
I couldn't tell which. "Make it a beam, then." He pushed his hat back. "I see sand mountains moved across the highway." Vodka and Root Beer looked up. "The hell you say?" "The hell you say? Used to be on the south side."
The geologist, who had pointed out earlier it was a crazy state, turned to me.
"Hear that? Couple boys arguing about a mountain crossing the highway."
The men went silent, sipped their liquor. Each convinced the other was wrong. A trucker came in for coffee. "You've lost weight, Lex."
"I'm working double shifts to pay for my new rig. Don't know if it's worth it. Guess it is for the little wife. Been up 32 hours now on a run to the coast and back. Just want to get home today."
When he left, one of the men said, "Sure hope the little lady knows Papa's on his way. She's quite the little at-home entertainer."
I wasn't ready for the road, so I stayed on after the others left and talked to the woman, whose name was Lori Chelander. She had attended the University of Nevada for 2 years while working the night shift for Nevada Bell as a long-distance operator in Reno. But the calls from drunks and would-be suicides depressed her. Looking for change, she had arrived in Frenchman 4 years earlier with her husband, whose parents had owned the town since 1970. "When I got married, friends said I wouldn't last 2 weeks out here. They made bets on it. Now I love Frenchmen. Maybe because no one else does."
"Do you get bored? Or lonely?"
"Let me put it this way. We've never plugged the television in. I work an 18-hour day with my mother-in-law. There aren't many people around, but we see 90% of the ones here. Always something happening, because this is the only place to eat, drink, and buy gas for a long ways, east or west, and even longer north or south. If it gets too dull, we climb the water tower and watch bombing runs. Night strafing with tracer bullets is better than the valley mirages."
"I wouldn't want to be in the air during strafing runs.
Safer up there than in here, when miners from the tungsten pit come around. Maybe that stuff does something to the brain. They're animals, not gentlemanly like cowboys. When I was pregnant, one came at me with a pool cue.
What happened?
We ran him out. We've got guns hidden. Got to. Nearest law is a half hour away in good weather. Time the sheriff gets here, show's over.
Sounds like a good place for a holdup.
All they get is a few bucks and a lot of lip. Then they've got to drive east or west. If they take a back road, you'd see the dust trail for 15 miles. Can't get away out here. Desert's hard to fence. The only thing I worry about is the diesel generator going out. But I hope we can tie into that new power line.
And another town of the Old West bites the dust.
Talk about biting the dust. Look at this.
She handed me a photograph of the place in 1906.
In front of the building was a stone well. Painted on it, "If you don't want to pay for water, leave it alone."
Chilander said,
"That's the second cafe. First one was built in the 1850s. We burn down about every 30 years. Ours is the fifth. That's a hand-dug well in the picture. Now we have to drill 300 feet to get good water."
I saw where the Overland Stage and Pony Express ran this route.
Everybody who's ever had the station does the same thing. Sell food, something to drink, and a bed. They used to sell oats for horses. We sell regular and unleaded. Paiutes and Shoshones used to come in for a drink, and they still do, except Paiutes call themselves Shoshones now because the Shoshones have a good name and a reputation of good-looking women.
How did the name Frenchman come about?
It used to be Frenchman's Station when it was a stage stop operated by somebody with a French name. I've heard they couldn't pronounce it, so they just called him the Frenchman.
Margaret Chilander came out of the kitchen.
She had moved to the station from San Francisco with her husband after he retired from General Motors. She said,
"We were living here when my husband died, but I've never wanted to move. Strange how this godforsaken place gets in you. In the summer it's 110, in winter it's 15 below. Telephone lines get blown down regularly, or they did before the microwave relay came in. When the lines went down, we were cut off, and I mean off. But you get to know yourself out here. You have to. And you get to know the others around, because we all have to look after each other. Out here, sooner or later, all of us need help. Look out for yourself, look out for each other. The law of the land."
She came around the corner to sit down.
"I think it's the distance between us that keeps us close. Everything here is important because there isn't much of it, except weather and dust. Once you see that, you're not lonely."
"Loneliness is blindness?"
"We've got bar tabs 3 years old," Laurie said. "They'll get paid someday. Can't afford to write anybody off. Last year a man, 72, and with an artificial leg, he came in a little oiled and then got tighter than Dick's hat band. When he tried to get to his car, I told him I was going to pull his leg off. He griped, but spent the night in the motel."
"The isolation," I was starting to say.
"You like it or you don't," Laurie said. "Callie, our daughter, is a fourth-generation Nevadan. That's something in a state where most people are from somewhere else. I wanted to have the baby on the pool table, but nobody would listen. So we had to make a 90-mile-an-hour drive to Reno at 3 in the morning. God, what a ride."
"On the pool table?"
"I don't think anyone's ever been born in Frenchman in 135 years.
A pool table on a bombing range? It would have been something for her to remember. 10. The argument whether or not Sand Mountain had crossed the highway made more sense when I saw the thing. A single massive mound of tawny sand, a wavy hump between two larger ridges of sage and rock. It was of such size that, while it wasn't perhaps big enough to be a mountain by everybody's definition, it was surely more than a dune. Nevadans once called it Singing Sand Mountain, because of the pleasant hum in the blowing sands. But no one has heard the mountain since off-road vehicles from California took it over. I crossed 8 Mile Flat,
a stretch of alkali crusts and shallow winter runoff where a machine scraped off salt crystals. It was near here in 1907, they tell, that a cafe owner preparing broilers for supper found two chicken craws laden with golden gravel. He at once butchered all his yard hands and found more nuggets. Because the flat contained no gold, he began looking for the source of the chickens and learned they had been raised on four separate farms before he bought them. Although the search lasted years, the chicken craw gold rush died as it was born. I stopped for a beer in Salt Wells at a place called Maxie's. If there was more to Salt Wells than that entirely Chinese red building, I didn't see it. An ornamental wrought iron fence covered the front. The gate was locked. Turning to leave, I noticed an arrow pointing to a button. Push me. I felt like Alice in Wonderland. I pushed. A dark face peered from a circle scraped on a window, painted red too. The gate clicked open, and I went inside where walls, ceiling, curtains, and light bulbs were bright red. A sign, "Dance with the ladies, 50 cents, 3 for $1. Below was a sticker, "Go Navy." A saloon as peculiar as the desert. That's when I realized it wasn't a desert saloon. It was a desert cat house. Bold and plain, directly on U.S. 50, and flagrantly red from top to bottom. Everyone, two Indians, two Negroes, a Chicano, and the bartender. All of them watched me. I ambled to the bar as if I'd known all along. Mirror decals showed the management accepted Visa, MasterCharge, American Express.
"Hey, Joe, what's your name?"
she asked. I don't know where she came from. "Al," I said.
"How about a party, Al?"
"What's your name?"
"Tiffany." "How do you like it, Al?"
"It's a fine name."
"Not the name, Al, baby. Your party. How do you like your party? Hot?"
Tiffany, with all due respect, was one of the most facially unfavored women I'd ever seen. Her features would have been woeful on a man, but on a woman who earned her way by sexual attraction, they were calamitous. She was a good dose of saltpeter. Yet nature, not withholding everything, had recompensed her with two impressive advertisements that she rested flat on the bar.
"How about a dance with a lady? 3 for $1.
"Dances or ladies?"
"Don't be cute, Allie. Just name your pleasures."
Allie it was now.
"I only stopped in to use the phone. You know, engine trouble with my rig. Got to report into the dispatcher."
She looked at me sympathetically.
"Are you gay, honey? Tiffany's helped 100 of your kind. Your problems show up like the honeymoon virgin."
I think that woman must have been a terrific salesperson. She had backed me into a dialectical corner with 3 or 4 sentences and left me only 2 escapes. Admit to deviance or prove a capacity to perform at her standard. The bartender edged over, insinuating a little pressure. Tiffany turned on her stool, and one of her portions on the bar followed. Another dancing lady came in. She was quite pretty.
"That's Faith,"
Tiffany said.
"Men prefer her. Maybe you would, too. I'm used to it. I mean, it's no surprise to Tiffany."
Another tack coming.
"I just hope if you have a little girl, she's beautiful. Because you men make it so tough on anybody who doesn't look like Debbie Boone."
Tiffany, I'll tell you the truth. I walked in here not realizing it was a place.
Sometimes us girls call it a whorehouse."
"Right. When I finish my beer, I'll have to get back on the road."
"So you're in a whorehouse. Too good for woman's company, Mr. Allen?"
The woman had the tactical mind of General Patton. She blocked me at every move. The bartender leaned in.
"Good buddy. Let Miss Tiffany help you. She's cured worse cases than yours. Why do you think she's called Tiffany? Pure class. 24 carat.
My case is okay. I just don't have the money."
"Look, Joe," Tiffany said, "you talk money. It's costing me to sit here trying to give a good time. You think I like crapping around with Tweeties?"
I drank my beer and took my case down the road, through the irrigated plain at Fallon, into hills, along the Truckee River, under a shelf of glowing clouds above downtown Reno, past signs offering candlelight weddings, no waiting, free witnesses. I stopped near the University of Nevada and put my case to bed. The geologist was right. It was one crazy state. 11. The next morning on the desert, I was awakened by the squeal of seagulls. I looked out the window. I should have been used to the vagaries of the desert, but I wasn't. Sure enough, a pair of gulls overhead. While the radio played, I washed up. The big news that Sunday in Reno was of a 73-year-old Canadian who had been coming to the casinos 3 times a year for 20 years. She had met with no success until last night, when she won $183,000. At breakfast in the university cafeteria, I sat by a student who, even with the orthodontics, had a face of ill-matched features. I mentioned the woman's win. "Rigged," he scoffed. "It's too good. A grandmother returning faithfully to Mecca for years, then finally hitting the big score. Why rig a loss? Cheapest and best advertising casinos can get. It'll go out on the wire services and be reported as news. It's believable, and it'll bring in new suckers and keep the fixtures hanging around. Makes casinos look good." The lady didn't really win. She probably won and still doesn't know how she hit a jackpot. The house had her checked out, knew how long she'd been coming here. I'll bet she's got a face sweet as a sugar bun. Of all the greasy scumbags down there every night, did you ever see any of them, big winners? I headed north out of Reno, crossed into California at an intersection once called Hallelujah Junction, because it meant arrival in Eureka Land, then turned west on State 70. At Beckworth Pass, only a mile high and the lowest route over the Sierra Nevadas, I hardly knew I'd crossed anything. But the mountains rose again on the other side, and the day became a dim, sodden thing, damp without rain. Dismal. The weather saturated me, and it may have provoked a dark fit of musing I fell into. While I had failed to put any fragments of the journey into a whole, I did have a vague sense of mentally moving away from some things and toward others. But in the Sierra gloom, even that notion seemed an illusion produced by motion down a highway, as if the road moved through me in a continual coming and going that was, in the long run, stasis. I was on a Ferris wheel, moving along, seeing far horizons, coming close to Earth, rising again, moving, moving, but all the time turning in the same orbit. Black Elk says, "Everything the power of the world does is done in a circle. A hope." Missourians sometimes speak of a place called Hacklebarney, a non-existent town you try to get to that is forever just around the next curve or just over the next hill, a town you believe in but never get to. Maybe that's enlightenment, always a little ahead of perception. Hindus represent their god of destruction, Shiva, by the Yoni Lingam symbols of regeneration to suggest the cyclical movement of coming into and going from being that never ceases. Even if a man resists belief in the fixity of things, even if he discredits the scope of human understanding, even if he sees a hint of metaphysics between cosmic and comic, Yiddish proverb, man thinks and God laughs, he still longs to arrive at a place of clarity. Just outside Portola, I crossed Humbug Creek. I didn't believe it. Nothing that apropos happens in real life. I stopped and walked back to the brook to see whether I saw what I thought I saw. Humbug Creek. I could almost hear the laughter from on high. The road made a long turn and headed northwest of a deep river valley of conifers where slab pine houses with tin roofs leaked a blue vapor of wood smoke from stovepipe chimneys into the mist. Apple trees were in blossom, but the leaves, still closed, waited for the right slant of vernal light. It came to me that I didn't recognize the coming of spring in this mountain country. At home, I could name the season by its angle of light, its color and shadow and sound and scent. but in the valley of the Middle Fork of the Feather River, the light and sound and smells were different. Quincy was a clean mountain town, empty and quiet but for a church bell. It was Sunday with a vengeance. Sunday in the churches, yes, but also Sunday in the streets, alleys, fields, even in the heart of the pines. Sunday is the day bells toll, the day funny papers come out, and with good reason. While the citizens sat under arched ceilings and spoke with their various gods and saviors, I scuffled with humbug in the laundromat. By noon, outfitted with a full set of washed clothes, I went again into the mountains. North of Keddy, the road passed a spring spilling from the side of a broken cliff. I emptied my jugs of city water and filled them with purity from the rocks and drank a pint to clear the pipes, then walked up into the trees to dispel the jounce of miles. The sun, breaking through now and then, cast long slopes of light down the mists, and for a time the vapors of humbug evaporated. Route 89 followed the Indian River, a frothing green turbulence, up into higher mountains. For miles, the only bridge across it was a rusty cable chair. The only things visible, the river and big firs and pines of the Plumas Forest. When I got to State 36, I had a choice of heading toward the Sacramento Valley farmlands or staying in the mountains. I took the road across Lassen Peak, a sharp ascent that disappeared in clouds. Halfway up, snowflakes the size of nickels dropped out of the cold. Cedar breaks. Then a sign saying the road was closed for winter. I inched the van back and forth until turned around, all the while cursing a sign not at the bottom of the mountain. Arriving again at the foot of Lassen, I started around it. Rain fell as I moved toward the valley, but on a ridge road between deep volcanic canyons, the shower stopped and a rainbow arched the highway canyon to canyon. The slopes were strewn with shattered thunder eggs, ejected from Lassen, a volcano last violently active only 60 years before. I took a road not marked on my map toward Manton. Nowhere was the way straight, but the land it traversed looked like an illustration from a child's book. A whimsy of rocky shapes, a fancy of spongy bushes, a figment of trees. Two loping deer could have been unicorns, and a fisherman under a bridge, a troll. The only reality was that somebody owned the land. At 300-yard intervals, alternating signs hung from barbed wire. No trespassing, private property. Wonderland stopped at Manton. I should have asked the way to Viola, but I didn't. Instead, I went hunting it up a highway through woods and new vineyards. The hills, unlike the weird rockiness I'd come from, looked softly rounded like full bellies. When the road became a narrow dirt trail, I turned around in the first clearing and headed back to Manton. Travelers are supposed to ask directions, but I believed, as usual, that I could find the way. Encouraged by a sign pointing to Viola, I tried another road. I had only to follow. Sunset vanished as the pavement again went into the woods. It narrowed progressively to a pair of wet troughs, and pine boughs screeched against ghost dancing. Having backed away from two roads already that day, I wasn't retreating again. Besides, I couldn't have turned a unicycle around in the thick forest. Muddy holes a small man on a small unicycle would have disappeared in rocked the truck violently, and nothing gave evidence I was getting anywhere but in deeper. If a tree lay across the trail, I'd be locked in this blackness, this home of Sasquatch, for the night. On and on, the pitching and squeaking. Why did I get into things like this? I wasn't going to get to Viola. Give up on that. Maybe I wasn't even going to escape the woods unless I walked out. But things got no worse. In fact, after a while, the wallows became shallower, the branches stopped screeching, the road widened, then the headlights bounced off striped pavement. Rain again. 10 minutes later, I reached what must have been Viola, a few darkened houses. Note to mapmakers, without a gas station, cafe, water tower, and stoplight, you don't have a town. I drove on in anger, then in weariness, and my eyelids drooped. Nothing for miles of darkness, until something loomed in front of the truck and gave a toothy grin just before I smudged it. Fearing what it might be, I stopped and ran back up the road. It lay shuddering, its legs trying to push it off the highway. I dreaded it. Whatever else it was black, fat, and wet. I played the flashlight over the body. There. An improbable bag of prickles. A big porcupine. All 30,000 quills of it. Its sleepy, feeble eyes glazed with shock. The legs stopped pushing, and it died. I rolled it off the road as its belly sloshed, full of whatever watery greens it had just eaten. What a day. Seagulls on the desert, rigged payoffs, mountains, Hallelujah Junction, Humbug Creek, a volcano, fairyland, vineyards, forest, mist, sun, rain, snow, a rainbow, doubt, hope. And now a goddamn dead porcupine. And here I was trying to make sense of things. I wiped the rain off my face and went on. 10 o'clock and I hadn't eaten since noon. I understood that no highway went for long without getting rough. But I couldn't break myself of the notion that whenever I hit good road, it would hold to the end. I just couldn't remember cycles, the circles. A wooden sign in the headlamps pointed to a small state campground. I pulled in under the ponderosas, the rain dubbing hard. I got out some bread and put it back. Too tired. The truck was as dark as the inside of a stone, and I was about to sleep under a volcano that had exploded within living memory, and I kept seeing the yellow grin of a porcupine, whose luck it was to have a path coincident with mine, and end the day as a ball of bloody meat.
12. Two Steller's jaybirds stirred an argy-bargy in the ponderosa. They shook their big beaks, squawked and hopped, and swept down the sunlight toward ghost dancing, and swooshed back into the pines. They didn't shut up until I left some orts from breakfast. Then they dropped from the branches like ripe fruit, nabbed a gobful, and took off for the tops of the 100-foot trees. The chipmunks got in on it, too, letting loose a high peal of rodent chatter, picking up their share, spinning the bread like pinwheels, chewing fast. It was May Day, and the warm air filled with the scent of pine and blooming manzanita. To the west, I heard water over rock as Hat Creek came down from the snows of Lassen. I took towel and soap and walked through a field of volcanic ejections and broken chunks of lava to the stream, bouncing off boulders and slicing over bedrock. Below one cascade, a pool the color of glacier ice circled in effervescence. On the bank at an upright stone, with a basin-shaped concavity filled with rainwater, I bent to drink, then washed my face. Why not bathe from head to toe? I went down with rainwater and lathered up. Now, I am not unacquainted with mountain streams. A plunge into Hat Creek would be an experiment in deep cold thermodynamics, I knew that. So I jumped in with bravado. It didn't help. Light violently flashed in my head. The water was worse than I thought possible. I came out, eyes the size of biscuits, metabolism running amok and setting fire to the icy flesh. I buffed it dry. Then I began to feel good, the way the old Navajos must have felt after a traditional sweat bath and roll in the snow. I dressed and sat down to watch Hat Creek. A pair of dippers flew in and began feeding. Robin-like birds with stubbed tails and large, astonished eyes. Dippers feed in a way best described as insane. With two or three deep knee bends, hence their name, as if working up nerve, they hopped into the water and walked upstream completely immersed, strolling and pecking along the bottom. Then they broke from the water, dark eyes gasping. I liked Hat Creek. It was reward enough for last night. Back at Ghost Dancing, I saw a camper had pulled up. On the rear end, by the strapped-on aluminum chairs, was something like the Wandering Watkins. Time to go. I kneeled to check a tire. A small, furry white thing darted from behind the wheel, and I flinched. Because of it, the journey would change. Harmless as a stuffed toy.
the voice came from the other end of the leash the dog was on. He's nearly blind and can't hear much better. Down just to the nose now.
The man, with polished cowboy boots and a part measured out in the white hair,